Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of The Supercharged Life. And I'm so excited about our guest today, Chef Rocco DiSpirito. He has written 5 New York Times bestsellers. He's a recipient of the prestigious James Beard Award. He's, in fact, published 14 cookbooks in total, appeared on countless TV shows, including my favorite, The Doctors, and made his mother's meatballs world famous. So let's welcome celebrity chef Rocco. Thank you so much for being here.
As well, and you're a foodie and my kind of people. And you're a neuropsychotherapist, and I have to say that I'm a big fan of your entire community. Every level of it, every person in it, a bunch of very giving, loving, helpful people in my life.
So, well, you know, thank you.
I've seen every kind of, you know, person that whose title ends in an ist.
Yes.
And so.
Oh, I'm good. Excited. Well, yeah. I know that you
are
familiar.
Neuropsychotherapist.
Yes.
You know, you're pharmacist.
Yes. And you're very familiar with therapists because you actually started going to one when you were a child.
Yeah, it's so funny. I've been in therapy since second grade, although I didn't know it until college. So when the counselor at college said, you know, we have a therapist on campus, you should attend. I thought to myself, oh, wow, that's what they've been doing to me my whole life. Because ever since second grade, I was taken out of class 1 hour a week. Uh-huh. And I was asked to draw and play with things. And you could probably tell me better, you know, better than I know that those are meant to, you know, get you to exemplify some behavior that should be instructional for the therapist. So I imagine that's what's been going on.
Well, I think as a child, sometimes children don't verbalize their emotions very well. So
yeah.
It starts
unless
with
you're in the
therapy.
Classroom, which is probably why they took me out of class, because I was probably verbalizing too much.
So, okay. So were you struggling with anxiety at the time? What was going on?
I think I was struggling with many things. Anxiety was probably at the top of the list. I didn't really understand. And I still struggle with this, what, you know, is socially acceptable in class, out of class, in the playground. I came from an immigrant family that had a really hard time acculturating. They were in their 30s and 40s when they came to the United States, so their mastery of English was almost none. We didn't speak English at home until I went to kindergarten and demanded that we change, you know, our language at home from Italian to English. So yeah, I was very confused as a kid and wasn't sure, you know, what culture and lifestyle I was exposed to at that time was the right one in public versus at home.
Right. I can imagine how that can really create just a sense of dissonance, right? Because you have a certain culture at home that is honored, and then you go to school and these Americanized kids. No one gets it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm from an immigrant family myself. And in fact, I'm an immigrant because I moved to the United States when I was 9.
Okay. Good. And so you understand. You understand really well. Yeah.
Yeah. My parents were in their 30s, and I don't think I could do what they did, which is uproot your life and go to a completely different country where you don't speak the language.
Right.
And try to read.
And just make a life for yourself.
Yeah.
They're amazing, our parents, huh? That generation, I doubt they're from the same generation, but a generation of immigrants have strength that I don't think I could find if I needed it. If I needed to move to another country right now, say because of, I don't know, coronavirus or something, I don't know that I could do it. I don't know that I could do it.
Yeah. I feel like I would not be able to do it. And I'm very happy admitting that. I think I'm used to my creature comforts in America. Yeah. And while other countries are very nice to visit, it'd be so different to try to insert yourself in a world where you don't understand. So,
especially because my backup country was Italy.
Yes.
I'm an Italian. I have an Italian passport. I'm an Italian citizen. And that was always going to be my backup country. Mm-hmm. And there will be no Italy for me in the near future.
Right. Yeah. When was the last time you were in Italy?
A couple of years ago. But I go often. I've written cookbooks there, shot TV shows there. I'm very familiar with it. I love the culture. It's funny because it took me until my mid-30s to sort of get rid of my ethnic self-loathing and love the Italian side of me and embrace it and make it part of my work.
Yes.
And had you met me in my early 30s when I was opening Union Pacific and asked me for a meatball recipe, I'd have laughed at you because I'd never made the meatballs and my mom was, you know, making these incredible dishes.
Yes.
But around 36, 7, 8, I sort of was like, wow, this is really the most wonderful part of my background. I have all these family members who live this culture. You know, this Italian culture in America, it's more Italian than American. Mm-hmm. They speak Italian at home. They make their own food. They grow their own food. You know, it's just this most rich and wonderful lifestyle, right? And in fact, some of their relatives live in what are called blue zones, but now I'm sure you're familiar, where people live to 100 and above very often because they have this wonderful lifestyle filled with, you know, homemade food, organics, food, spirituality, purpose, community. And so I should have been following that the whole time.
Yes.
Someone should have clued me in.
Italian culture, I feel like, is the epitome of amazing food and so much other things. Yeah. Like you said, community, togetherness. Yeah. I was just recently in Italy myself a few months ago. Yeah. My husband is Italian descent.
Oh, and great.
He's three quarters Italian, a quarter Greek. Wow, cool. So we went to Italy and we just love the culture. The food was so good every day.
People are so nice, right? It's so easy to get along there. You know?
Yes. Very, very different. Yeah. But like you said, America can be kind of scary for someone who's just trying to figure things out. And so as a kid, you actually struggled with some of that anxiety and knowing what the social...
On the way here, I struggled with it.
Did you?
I was always struggling with it. I think once you're, when you're born a first generation immigrant kid that grows up in a city like New York and then a part of the city called Jamaica, Queens, which is one of the most ethnically diverse places in the world. So I didn't go out of my house and encounter, you know, American graffiti America. Mm-hmm. I encountered another 100 ethnicities who each had their own culture that and I didn't know what I should do, you know? So I tried to hold on to my Italian American upbringing and tried to sort of embrace the American, the clearly American things like the football and the baseball, you know, those. So the Yankees were a big part of my childhood growing up, collecting baseball cards. Mm-hmm. Oddly enough, Bruce Lee was a big part of my childhood growing up because he was as American as it got at the time. And he was on, you know, his movies were out all the time at that time. Mm-hmm. But it's always very confusing. Anyway, my mom also had to struggle with the same thing. She came here in her mid 30s alone. No husband, no children, sponsored a bunch of her family members to come over and then got married and brought a child over. And my dad couldn't come for several years due to immigration policies. And so she had a real hard time too. But she really made the best of it with her broken English and all the struggles that she had. She just made it look easy. So I feel a little, when I complain about this, I feel a little like I shouldn't be complaining because clearly other people get through this just fine.
Well, I think everybody's so different in terms of how they respond to certain types of challenges, because some of the challenges that you've had and the success that you've been able to achieve, I think other people, their minds would be blown. How did you do that? How did you overcome this? And I think one of the things that you have worked hard at overcoming is the social anxiety piece and yet always being in the spotlight. Because you're constantly on TV shows, you're a public figure. And it's so interesting to think about your origin story, where as a child, that stuff probably just freaked you out so much and you couldn't even imagine a career
child,
like this.
As a young adult, I've told the story to many people about my early days at my first really big restaurant where I used an acting coach named Nancy Banks, who lives in Los Angeles, to help me act through and simulate encounters with my customers, because I was so anxious and so unable to go out into a dining room and say, "Hey, how was your meal? I'm Rocco. I'm the chef. I cooked this for you. What do you think?" And it's funny because that was a time where I couldn't hide in the kitchen anymore. I was very happy hiding in the kitchen and just making great food and getting feedback through waiters and my partners. And then at some point in the 90s, the chef had to step out, because marketing yourself became as important as cooking. Marketing yourself became as important as making the great product. So it became a very difficult choice to make every night. How much time do I spend out in the dining room marketing myself versus how much time do I spend in the kitchen making the product perfect?
Right.
And that's when a lot of my other problems started with, you know, becoming a known chef in the current industry that we, you know, we're all familiar with now, thanks to food television and all the press chefs get.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
I'm actually a huge fan of food television. My favorite time to watch it is when I'm hungry.
No,
because then I just look forward
to
eating. I know. Then I just want to have a huge meal after.
Something, you know, covered in cheese. It'll be something covered in cheese. Yeah.
I know. And it's so great because I actually learned so much because most people are visual learners, but I especially feel like I am. So I like watching them prep the food and, oh, I never thought about doing that or adding this ingredient. But I understand the dissonance you must have had when you thought, oh, well, my passion is to cook the food and make the product perfect. And now this whole other element where basically you have to market yourself and your food. And that's why you had to hire an acting coach to literally run through role plays with
role
you.
Role play,
like pretend I'm a customer and then you come out and what will you say? And what if a customer complains? What will you say back? Mm-hmm. What if they give you a compliment? Yeah. So you had to really do it almost in a very mechanical way to get the craft down, the mechanical, technical.
The mechanical of the mechanics of marketing and being charming in a dining room.
Yeah.
And also for television, we role played the Today Show, you know, someone played Katie Couric and someone played, you know, we really did this quite a lot because I was starting to do a lot of TV appearances. And the ironic thing is I was one of the early chefs to become criticized for doing too much of that.
Wow.
And the whole time I've been thinking, I don't want to do any of that, but the industry is forcing me and the competition in New York and in the country is forcing all of us to sort of abandon a life in pursuit of perfection of product for a life where you're marketing 24/7, where you're, you know, hustling and pimping your product 24/7. And it's, you know, to this day, a very difficult choice.
Yeah.
But I do, if you ask me what I'd love to do for most of my day, every day, what's spiritual for me, it's still cooking. It's still chopping an onion, heating up a pan, listening to the sizzle, making something for a few hours, feeding it to someone, watching them, you know, enjoy the food that I made. And that's it. It's a very simple life. If I could have that, just that, I'd choose it in a heartbeat.
Well, I think chefs are amazing because really you're feeding people. You're literally providing nourishment to them, but also there's such an emotional element because it's love.
Yeah.
And my grandmother, who I adore and is like a second mother to me, she cooked for us all the time. And anytime I ate her dishes,
you felt the love ingredient.
You really
feel
the love. Yeah. And I love that you also compare your career to a type of spirituality. So obviously everybody lives their spiritual life in different ways. Mm-hmm. And there was actually a stint where you considered being a priest. Understand that because I'm Catholic.
Oh, okay.
I'm still a practicing Catholic.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So
great.
I know some priests. Some of these priests are my friends. One of them came actually to my book signing party.
Amazing.
You know, and having alcohol because, you know, priests can drink. So it's fine.
Yeah.
So he was there drinking his bourbons.
Priests can and will drink.
That's right. They love
drinks. In case you didn't know.
They love drinks. Yeah. But you actually considered that as a career path.
Not only considered, I pursued it. I went to a seminary, high school. I will say that my mom put a little pressure on me. Probably if you have a brother, I don't know if you have a sibling who's eligible for priesthood, but there's a good chance your mom might have thought, oh, I'd like one of my children to become a priest or a nun or something like that. But again, my mom's generation is the World War II generation. So it's for them, and especially coming from Italy, you know, being a priest was like a huge honor.
Maybe one day you could be the Pope and be the Vatican, right?
You could be the president, but then you know, they'd say, no, but he's a priest. It's much better. But I also looked at it through the metrics of what's good for me academically. And I was always sort of practical in that sense. And that was the best academic choice that I had. The kids who graduated from the school went to Harvard and Princeton, Yale, and West Point. And a lot of them also went to this major seminary. They called it the major seminary. 50% went to the major seminary and on to priesthood. I just knew I was going to learn a lot. It was going to be a great academic experience. Mm-hmm. Then my family moved and ended up in a public school where I literally spent barely 2 years and graduated because I did so much work in the first year.
Wow.
That I didn't need to go to class for the last year. So I took a summer course. I accelerated through high school and I got into cooking school much faster than I expected, which turned out to be a wonderful thing for me.
So how did you decide that seminary wasn't going to be for you and the priesthood wasn't going to be good for you?
I felt very uncomfortable from day one. I love the academic part of it. There were some teachers I really enjoyed. I made very close friendships with people that I still, I'm still close with today. It's funny that you said one of your priests visited your book signing, because yeah. that just happened to me recently.
Oh, yeah, yeah. How funny.
And yeah. I just ultimately wasn't comfortable in the environment. And when I saw what a traditional American high school looked like in a suburban neighborhood, not Queens, it looked so attractive to me. You
know? Yeah.
There were girls, guys, cars, you know, movies, popcorn. There's all, you know, all that stuff that you see in the movies. And
yes.
that was my first exposure to it. So I was like, yeah, I'll take this. This looks great. Mm-hmm. And then quickly I realized that this is nowhere near ambitious enough for me. So yeah. I need to get to the next step pretty quickly.
Yeah. And how did you discover your love of cooking?
So I always loved cooking. My parents were lower middle class, you know, at best. My mom always worked multiple jobs. We had boarders in our house, literally people living in our home. Mm-hmm. This was the advent of the deinstitutionalization of hospitals in New York and across America. And so there are all of these people who needed to live in, you know, what would you call them? Not halfway houses, but in private homes. Mm-hmm. where they'd get counseling, but someone needed to take them into their home. So my mom was more than happy to do it because she loved taking care of people, and we probably needed the money. And so we had two boarders in our house. And the point of the story is that we didn't have a lot of money to spend on things like records and posters mm-hmm. and whatever. And I was really into a band called Kiss, and my mother hated it because she thought they were demonic. For real. Like, she thought they were really a cult and really demonic, man. And were really going to lead me down a bad path.
Right, right.
So I wanted to buy an album called Love Gun. She wouldn't give me the money. We had a fight. She announced that if I wanted to buy anything to do with them, I'd have to go out and get a job and buy it with my own money. Like, it was a big dare. Mm. And I was 11, and I thought, what? Woman, I can go out and get my own job and make my own money, and I don't have to have this conversation.
Right, right.
Done. So the next day, I literally walked into a pizzeria after, you know, asking many, many people. And he said, yes, I'll give you a job. No problem. So I started working in a restaurant, and I fell in love with cooking and the hospitality business immediately. Mm. The interaction between people was wonderful. The magic that happens in that space where, you know, you're just feeding somebody, whatever, even if it's a fountain soda. It was magical to me. I got to eat all the Italian ice I wanted, and I made 50 cents an hour, which was a tremendous amount of money for me.
That's an adult wage, right? Yeah. I mean, at that time, that was a big deal.
Yeah, not far from an adult wage. It was 1977, so it was all right. And then he let me work, how generous of him. He let me work 60 hours a week, so I made $30. I made $30 a week. It was the best thing I've ever. It was an intense lesson in independence, and I bought a Stones album, a really bad album, and then I bought Love Gun by Kiss, and it was just like a great life moment, early lesson in independence and what adulthood feels like. And I worked in restaurants ever since. And at 14, I was working in a German restaurant that had very serious food, very serious menu. Mm. The first day there, they were making head cheese, which is pig's heads boiled until they fall apart and pulled apart and then compressed into a form. It was the first thing I saw walking into that restaurant.
Wow.
And at that point, I started to get very serious about being a chef. There were very serious chefs there. And so.
Yeah, you had mentors there.
Yeah.
And at the age of 14, you really, an idea formed in your head.
You're malleable and enough to where people can be very impressive. And so there was a guy there who went to the Culinary Institute of America, and he was always talking about how great it was. And I decided that's where I was going to go. And I did 2 years later.
Wow. So what was your first signature dish that you remember?
First signature dish I created and I'm most proud of is something I created for two restaurants before Union Pacific, a place called Dava. It was sea urchin with tomato water and mustard oil. And then I added raw bay scallops to it a few years later. And to this day, people know me for that dish. So it's not the meatballs. My mom was famous for the meatballs. Hers were amazing. Mine were like, okay, but it's that dish. And I wrote a book called Flavor, explaining how that dish pretty much summed up my philosophy on food and flavor, how four major tastes, sour, salt, sweet, bitter, make up all the dishes that we eat. And every dish is some combination of those. So that's my signature dish.
Yeah,
I'll show you a picture later.
I would love Beautiful to see dish, it. Yeah. I would love to see it. And that cookbook won the James Beard
it
Award.
It did, yeah.
So that was your first cookbook,
yes,
too.
Yes.
So what year was that? 2000?
2002, I think.
2002, yes. So, yeah. And you've published 14 books.
Yeah, you know,
since
they'll
then.
Let anyone write a book these days.
I don't know. Well, I don't know about that. That's a very funny, self-deprecating humor you have there. Was that practice? Was that role play?
No,
I'm kidding. But it's really great that you have been able to be so prolific. And I think sometimes people think, how can somebody have so much creativity, right? Where do all your ideas come from? Because if you have 14 cookbooks, you probably have thousands of recipes just floating around in your head at all times. So
I have lots of ideas floating around. Ingredients provide me with ideas. When I look at food, I get ideas. Mm-hmm. You know, I guess the opposite of anxiety and depression is mania. So there's probably some of that going on, you know. But I've there's always a natural connection between myself and food. And then when I learned how to cook healthy food in, you know, the mid 2000s, I really wanted to write a book about it. And then I wanted to write a lot of books about it because I feel like I discovered something sort of magical almost. And the doctors was kind enough to have me on for that first book. And it's called Now Eat This. And, then my cooking had a purpose other than just to entertain and fulfill some sort of emotional need at the moment.
Right.
And it became very important for me to learn, continue to learn about healthy cooking and share everything I learned.
Right. Yeah. Well, there's some pros and cons to anxiety, because obviously anxiety can be very troublesome, distressing, can keep you from doing certain things, but also anxiety can drive progress to a degree. And I know that you're a self-described perfectionist. So what does success mean to you? Because I think when people look at you and they look at all your accolades and all of your achievements, I mean, you've been on numerous TV shows, the 14 cookbooks, so affiliated, and so many people know who you are and your work. What is success? What's the end goal for you?
What's success right now? How do I define it right now?
Yeah.
It's right now, I would define it very differently than I would have described it 20 years ago. Right now it's peace. It's having peace, which means not a lot of conflict in life. Being surrounded by kindness and generosity, the ability to work or not. Not that I'll ever not work, because that's just how I'm wired, you know. I'm always working on something. But it's nice to be able to, I think success would mean that you could choose what you'd want to work on. There's lots of, you know, mitigating factors and outside influences. So to be free of those influences and mitigating factors would be a definition of success for me. Eliminating fear from my life, you know, not being so fearful of what's going to happen in the next moment, tomorrow, in 6 months. Our, you know, current struggles with all the things that are going on in the world are not helping me eliminate fear from my life. But, you know, just being at peace with whatever happens, I think that's the kind of thing, you know, a wonderful 95-year-old grandmother achieves on, you know, their deathbed usually. Yes. I'm not sure I'm ever going to get there, but that's what I'm working towards.
Yeah, that's the goal.
No.
Do you feel like you're a little bit of a catastrophizer, where you think into the future and you're already seeing so many steps ahead to the point where, if the worst happens, what's my plan?
So I think about what's going to happen a lot. And often I imagine catastrophes. I don't dwell on it as much as I'm making myself sound like I do right now. I do have the ability to just say, oh, that's nonsense. Don't worry about it. Just keep moving through today and enjoy the moment sometimes, not all the time.
So practicing mindfulness, which of course is such a buzzword, but it's important.
Very important. I mean, impulse control is one of the first things I learned in therapy, and mindfulness comes from impulse control and being able to just stop the cycle and think and be conscious is so important, right? And mindfulness comes from that practice.
I hate meditation, by the way, right? As a psychotherapist, as a psychologist, I actually despise traditional meditation. But I like other types of mindfulness activities, like a walking meditation, or, you know, there's a lot of different ways to have mindfulness. Even journaling is mindfulness. So once I got through that brain block, it helped me with that a bit more. But I'm not that person who can just kind of sit there.
Yeah, I've tried it. I've tried many times. Yeah. I just Too many thoughts racing around in there for me to slow down. I even went to a place to learn yoga and meditation. It's called Yoga for the Yoga Glee Challenge. And it's at this incredible place in Big Sur, and you eat only vegetarian food. And it's designed for that. And I was able to do it there, but once I got out, I wasn't. But
Right.
But yeah.
When you were being guided through it, though.
It was great when I was being guided through it. Yeah, there was guided meditation. It worked really well.
Yeah, I love that. And you mentioned that in the past, your success or definition of it looked different. So what was it in your 20s and maybe early 30s? What was just, that definition?
The nonstop pursuit of something financial, something with a certificate, something with a newspaper article that came with it. It all was very outside, external, not a lot coming from inside. Mm-hmm. And while that's wonderful, and I do appreciate all those accomplishments and the recognition they come with, they don't fill the void. You know, they don't fill they don't fill the space that we're all trying to fill every day. So, and I'm very grateful for those opportunities. And to this day, you know, the fact that at the standard we made it into the Michelin Guide was so important to me, and I'm thrilled that we did it. But it's an external thing. It's not long lasting, you know?
Right.
So back then it was a lot of, you know, reinforcement from people on the outside, and that's all I was sort of after. I mean, I did have a pure interest in cooking, and that turned into creating things for other people to enjoy that they actually enjoyed. Mm-hmm. And I knew that was true for a fact. And, was very lucky to be in New York at that time cooking. It was a very special time in New York. The New York customer base allowed us to be very free as artists. Now in New York, you'll see that a lot of the menus are very similar, and everyone's, you know, sort of services are contracting, not expanding. Everyone's very concerned about, you know, financial issues in the restaurant business. So this is not our heyday. Back in the 90s, sort of was the heyday for all of us.
And I think
so moving from external, you know, recognition to a place where you can derive inner peace is sort of the journey I've been on.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people are going to resonate with that, because as a society, we're sort of taught to seek that type of what we call hedonic happiness, right? Where this those bursts of joy when you achieve something external, or the minute you first land at an awesome vacation spot, you have that amazing flood of positive emotions. Mm-hmm. But eventually that does go away.
They wear off, yeah.
And then as you work further on self-development, and I think certainly as we get older, you start to realize that there's a different kind of happiness where it's really more based on your values and the time you spend with people who you care about. And I think it really clicked for me when I lost my grandmother, and realizing that no one on their deathbed is talking about the diplomas and the awards, right?
They're exactly.
just happy to be there with their family, holding hands with them. And I know that you suffered a major loss yourself. In fact, it was your mother who I know is a hero for you.
Yeah.
And you want
to
embody a lot of her values, like kindness.
Yeah.
She's
so my
kind.
Mother was extraordinary in a lot of ways. Anyone who met her could attest to the fact that she made them feel special and loved and like they had value in this world. I mean, anyone, any person. And she had, you know, a gift for being extraordinarily generous with her humanity. And I don't have that gift. I look to her as an example of a person that I'd like to be more like, and I'm working towards being like her a little bit more every day. But she was very special. She was very generous, very good mother. Mm-hmm. You know, the mechanics of being a mom, just being sure we were fed and clothed and taken care of. And then the spiritual side was very important to her. She was able to be unselfish many, many times, where it would have been very easy for her to be selfish. When she was sick, she was unselfish. When she was dying, she was unselfish. Mm. She made it very easy for us to understand, you know, and accept the fact that she was going to die.
I don't know how somebody could do that,
She talked to him. She was willing to have those hard discussions, you know, and in the middle of random conversations, she'd say, you know, when I die, don't be unhappy. I lived a great life. I have you, you have me. I want you to celebrate. Please play music at my funeral. I mean it when I say I want you to be happy, you know. Yeah. And she left all these crazy instructions and I carried them out at her funeral and I got criticized for it. I was like, this is literally what she asked for. So she had the presence of mind to be able to, you know, conquer the stuff that this world, the challenges that this world brings you. And I think it was her spirituality that helped.
It must her, be. Yeah. But still, I consider myself a spiritual person. I cannot imagine myself having so much peace while you're struggling with the fact, yeah. right? Because she was the one who, she knew she was going to be dying. And actually, I guess it happened in 2005, right? Was when she first became sick after a heart attack.
And then
you became her caregiver.
I became her primary caretaker, yeah.
Which is such a, also
it's just a little bit of work.
Switch.
It's no big deal. You can do that in spare time.
No,
so if you're a good caretaker, it becomes everything, right? It becomes your primary job. And I was very happy to do it, and I wouldn't change a thing if I had to do it again. And I'm thankful because I don't know that I would have had those 11 years with her as close and as meaningful and as rich an experience as it was if she and I didn't need each other or she didn't need me to be there for her like that. So I'm sort of grateful because most people don't see much of their parents as they, you know, leave this world, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And you were extremely busy professionally, and yet you were her primary caregiver.
Yes.
So how did you balance those responsibilities? Because each one is definitely its full-time job and a half.
Yeah. So the first thing I did is I moved her next to me. We lived literally next door to each other in New York City. Mm-hmm. I moved her to a facility that had some supervision at first. And then when it was clear she needed 24-hour care, which she refused for many years. Yeah. I finally won that fight after her stroke, and I got her really good 24-hour care. But I obviously had to supervise and maintain all those relationships, and I had to learn a lot about medicine and how hospitals work and how doctors work and how to advocate I hired consultants who were advocates, nurse advocates, physician assistant advocates. And if anybody's listening and they're going through the same thing, hire those people. It's worth every penny just to know that you can advocate for yourself, just to watch someone do it for you and then learn that you can do that for yourself, you know, is an amazing epiphany. It's such an illuminating moment when someone goes up to whoever comes in the room and says, hey, by the way, boom, 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 boom. I want to see the results now. Go back, get those results, come back, you report to me. We never have that experience in the hospital. Usually they tell us what to do.
Deferential to the doctors, right?
Like, oh, yes. bowing.
Right.
And meanwhile, the care is not coordinated. And medicines are contraindicated. I mean, there's so many things that you need to be cautious about. So someone has to have their brain on that full time. And that was me. And I feel like someone should write a book about how to, I'm sure there are plenty in existence, but that curve, that learning curve from going to from just a child to a caregiver is pretty steep. And there should be at least a 10-page manual.
Maybe an 100-page manual because it is such a flip in responsibility, roles, and identity.
Yeah.
This is the person who gave you life, who took care of you.
They're
your safe haven. And all of a sudden it flips. And
you're
their safe haven, but yet I'm hearing that at the same time, your mom still continued to be in her own way because she kept saying, don't worry about me. It's okay.
Yeah. I want to die. Don't worry. I'm good. I know where I'm going. I'm going to be fine. Let me die.
That just blows my mind. I really can't comprehend as she is beyond this world for sure.
Yeah.
But I think that sometimes people in an effort to try to empathize with you and maybe provide you with some comfort when your loved one finally passes away, they say things to you like, well, at least you had a quality time with her, or at least you had time. And I think sometimes they don't realize that when there is a chronic illness that gets dragged out, you're basically then just grieving the entire time.
Yeah. And getting
years and
understanding that, you know, this is the beginning of the end, right?
Right.
The first heart attack, I thought, oh, this is okay. We're going to fix this. She survived. And doctors were like, yeah, she could live a long life after this. And then every time something else happened, it was like, well, she might live another 5 years. She might live another 6 years, another 3 years. So that slow process where you realize this is absolutely for sure the end is a tough time.
Right.
So when we got to the end, it wasn't as tough as I expected it, because she'd been preparing us. I'd been preparing myself, mm-hmm. and all of our doctors and all the people around us have basically been telling me for, you know, a year or two at that point, that at some point there's going to be so many things going on, we're not going to be able to get her out of it. And she had great care, and those doctors and nurses and HHAs, that home health assistants, were like truly angels and did so much for her and treated her like family. And then while you're doing that, of course, you can't take care of yourself, right? Because you're trying to earn a living, take care of your mom, do all
that
stuff.
You come last.
Yeah, so I had a few rough patches with myself. Mm-hmm. I got through most of them. I'm sort of coming out of another rough patch right now. Mm-hmm. Because I had back surgery, and you know, the self-care just falls to the bottom of the list. Mm-hmm. And I wrote a book about health and wellness that just came out, and so it's kind of odd because I'm not in my best shape ever, mm-hmm. and I've been on the show in my best shape ever. Mm-hmm. Well, the doctors. When I say this show, I mean the doctors, right? I think of it like my family because they've been with me this whole journey. And now I'm getting people who are saying, you look terrible. Like, how can you sell a book on health and wellness? I'm like, well, we're not perfect, you know?
Right.
We have rough times too.
Yeah.
And I come right out front and say, listen, this is not me at my best, but this book is a good book and these recipes still work and keto will help you lose weight.
Yeah.
So there's all that going on right now.
It's so annoying that you have to defend that.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned earlier, because you have to market your product. That's why everyone's looking and they're saying, well, but I have this other picture of you from X year and you look this way. And it's so tough because I think you bring up this huge element of self-care that people still think that it's selfish, that there's a lot of stigma against it. And especially when you're caring for somebody, a loved one. I feel like sometimes it feels like a little bit too indulgent almost to be taking care of yourself in that moment, or at least that's the perception. Well, these other things have to come first. My businesses, my career, my mom, other family members who are grieving my mom, you know? And then where does that leave room for you? Mm-hmm. So what were some of the rough patches that you went through during that time?
So leaving Rocco's and Union Pacific when my mom first became my dependent, I guess you would call it, or mm-hmm. the person I had to care for, was a rough patch. My self-care was zero. Mm-hmm. Then I got into, through a couple of accidents and I don't know, you know, magic and the universe speaking to me, I was asked to be on The Biggest Loser. I was asked to do a triathlon for charity. Mm-hmm. My doctor told me my numbers weren't great, and I'd been complaining to him that my numbers weren't great my whole life. Mm-hmm. And he'd always told me that you're a hypochondriac. You need to get, you know, you need to stop worrying. Your numbers are great. You're a young man. You're healthy. And I remember him saying, hey, guess what? Your numbers are finally not great. So congratulations. You have something to worry about. And he said, I need you to get on these medicines, you know, because I don't like how the numbers look. And I want, you know, 20 years from now for you to be okay. And I remember we went through all the medicines and there were three medicines and that was a lot for me, going from zero to three.
Right.
And we talked about side effects. Side effects are all terrible, of course. And then he said, but you could also diet and exercise. And I said, oh, you mean if I do that, I don't have to take the medicines or I'll still have to take the medicines? He was like, if you do that, you probably won't have to take any of the medicines. Mm. He said, I tell everyone that, but no one ever does it. I was like, okay, I'll be the first. Let me be the first.
Yeah.
And so that confluence of events and the triathlon especially got me on a path where I was really taking good care of myself and learning what taking good care of yourself means, learning what foods will get you there, what mm-hmm. foods will get you to a good weight, what foods will sustain tremendous endurance, mm-hmm. athleticism like a triathlon. And it was a several year period, but I got to the best shape of my life and I was in my 40s. Mm-hmm. And I sustained that for a long time. I did the United States Championships for triathlons in Florida. And I have three bikes on my wall to attest for it. But there were, you know, there were moments where it just fell apart because I lost my mom, my dad, a pet, a few other things mm-hmm. happened all in the same sort of 3 to 5 year period.
Wow.
And then my back surgery. And don't want anyone to feel sorry for me. Obviously, I mm-hmm. know that everyone goes through this stuff. Mm-hmm.
But it was just in rapid succession.
But it's just a lot. You know, it's a lot of stuff happening. Yeah, it's a lot of stuff happening.
Yeah, well, and then you lost your mobility for a bit because you actually needed spine surgery. So were you born with scoliosis?
Yes, yes.
How did you keep it at bay all of these years? I remember those exams like bend and maybe your
exactly.
spine.
So in my time, there was really nothing they could do. Now they can fix it before puberty if you have it. And if it shows up during puberty, which is where most of the time it does, they can still fix it. I mean, if you go to a great chiropractor, they can absolutely straighten it out. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're a believer in chiropractic care or not, but I am a huge believer in, you know, functional medicine. And my chiropractor is the one who asked me to do the triathlon, by the way, for his charity. And he didn't tell me it was a triathlon until it was time to show up, basically. And so he kept me working and going without surgery for many, many years because he was really good at what he did. And the whole time he said, you know, listen, I'm going to keep you away from surgery as long as possible. Eventually you're going to need it. I know that, but for the next 10, let's see if we can go 10, 15 years. We went 20 years, you know, without surgery. And then finally it just, you know, nerves get compressed and all of a sudden your right leg doesn't move anymore and you're in a wheelchair trying to get around and you need surgery. And, luckily in New York, we have some of the best doctors in the country. And so I went to a place called HSS and they have a great doctor and, he took care of it, but it was, you know, it was months of being in a wheelchair, months of complete immobility and then recovery from surgery, which takes time. I remember trying to get on my bike, which is something I did multiple times a week. Mm. An average ride was 40 miles, 60 miles.
Wow.
And I did that 3-4 times a week with such joy in my heart. You know, I really loved it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember getting on my bike. I think it was three months after surgery, which was the minimum time you had to wait. And I waited for the day after the minimum time and I couldn't go a mile and I was just so crushed, you know? And then I tried to do my soul cycle, which was something I did a lot and just couldn't get through it. And I think I got really discouraged, but, it's time, you know, it's probably time for me to get back on and see what I can get done.
Yeah, I mean, you had major surgery. You had a discectomy. So those things, I mean, some people never feel like they can bounce back.
Oh, is that right? Thank you.
I mean, you'll be fine. But I just think that people feel that way afterwards.
No, I know you're
it's
right.
It's just a perception too, because it takes a longer period of time to train back.
Yeah.
Everything is so much slower.
Yeah. I have to get my bike refit, which means there's a new normal. I can't sit in my bike the way I used to. I'm going to have to get like the old band fitting now.
Right.
Everything is upright, you know?
Yeah. Way to deal with all of our existential crises, right? And I think, I mean, again, not everybody is a saint like your mom. I think almost every one of us has existential crises of death, changing bodies, things not working the way that they used to. And you had to confront all of those things at the same time. So you did have this, as you just described, this rapid succession of just loss after loss after identity change. And there was just so many things happening at once. And it's not hard to imagine why the self-care just completely went out the window. Yeah. So as you think about that now, and as you're getting back on that journey, what led you to say, no, I've got to start doing that again, start taking care of myself and reorient yourself towards that lifestyle?
Utter disgust with myself, clothes not fitting anymore, people reacting not so kindly with less generosity than they used to. And the sense that I really understand how to do it, right? So I've written about it. I've done it myself.
Yes.
I understand the mechanics of it. I understand the philosophy. I understand the science. And I guess I've just... It's taken me a couple of years to understand. I worked on the line for 2 years straight at the Standard and was able to do that. Funny enough, that skill never is compromised. So I can do that anytime, anywhere for 15 hours, no problem. And I did that every night on the line at the Standard. And I'm not sure, it must be muscle memory or something, but no matter what my physical condition is, I can cook on the line for 14 hours. Anyway.
Wow.
Some of the reaction is, you know, I understand that some of the reaction from the public comes from just a silly place, but some of it's legit because I have been for over 10 years trying to be a model of what living a healthy lifestyle means and writing books about it and being an advocate for it. And I understand their disappointment. I'm disappointed too. So that's figuring, you know, pretty prominently. Mm-hmm. And then at my age, this starts to become very serious, right? If I allow this to get too out of hand, mm-hmm. then I'm looking at the same problems my mom had. Right. And I definitely don't want to repeat that cycle because that's not a fun one, you know?
Right. Hmm. Yeah. And I think that it is hard because sometimes people think, okay, you're a health and wellness role model. And somehow you're supposed to have it all figured out. Mm-hmm. I think it's so much more motivating and inspiring when you can actually see their entire journey, mm-hmm. all the pitfalls, all the times when they struggle. Because if you never struggled, how can you teach people and actually relate to them on that level, right? Because if you don't know what they're going through and you just say, well, do this because this is what happens, I don't know if you have any credibility in some ways, because yeah. then you haven't even dealt yeah. with the challenges. So how can you know mm-hmm. what it's like to be on the other side? And so while people are judgmental, I think it says a lot more about themselves than it does about you. But mm. I know that at the moment it doesn't feel that way. You know?
And there have been people who've said, you know, I don't love that you're going through this, but I really think you understand me now. You know, I think that you understand what the average person goes through, because I'm not average in the sense that I have a food delivery system where I get food delivered to my house. Mm-hmm. It's my business. So it's not that unusual that you would have your own food sent to you, but
yeah.
I eat the best food you can make every
yes.
day, you know,
yes.
Except when I'm judging one of the TV shows that you've probably seen on Food Network,
sometimes
then it goes sideways
so
completely. Yeah. But so I think it's good for me to understand what people who are really struggling are struggling with.
Yeah.
And I think it's good for, you're right, it's good for them to see me struggle and hopefully overcome, you know, at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So what are some of the things that you're doing now to get back into
So just, you know, the consciousness, just the what I tell other people to do, which is not crave and consume, but crave and be conscious, right? Crave and make a decision.
Yeah.
Think, you know, impulse control, mm-hmm. what are the ramifications of this food choice you're about to make or beverage mm-hmm. choice you're about to make? So just, you know, giving myself that speech and, yeah. and making that a more important part of my life every day and understanding that even if I'm going to judge a cooking show where I'm going to have to eat, you know, I don't know what for 3 days,
yes.
there are still ways to mitigate the, you know, the losses of gains that will happen because of that.
Right.
And then the physical activity, I'm just making making it really important for me to figure out what physical activity will be comfortable for me in this mm-hmm. post, you know, surgery world.
Yeah.
And it's going to take some time and I'll just have to figure it out.
How is your pain now? Is it okay? Are you able to do most things?
It was acute sciatica. So the pain was, you know, 10 out of 10 all the time.
Oh.
Now it's, you know, in the 2-3 range. It'll always be there. I mean, yeah. And my doctor thinks I'm going to need surgery again in about 10 years. Mm-hmm. You know, the crazy one with all the pins and rods. And
oh,
all that
no.
stuff. Yeah, yeah. So.
But you got 10 years.
Yeah, I've got 10
you
years.
You got
yeah.
10 years. Yeah. Don't think about that
If I give
now.
Myself those 10 years, right?
Right.
If I make sure I'm, because being healthy and having a low body weight and all that's very important mm-hmm. in terms of how your spine, you know, heals yeah. and.
I will be the first to admit that I struggle deeply with existential crises, and actually it didn't really happen until my grandmother died, because again, she was such an important figure for me. She was the reason why our entire family was Catholic. She was the first one who was converted when she was in Taiwan. I was raised by her because my parents were both so busy and working for the first few years of my life. I didn't really see them much because they would come home after I fell asleep.
It's great. You were lucky. Grandmas are the best.
Oh, they're the best. She walked me to kindergarten. Yeah. She cooked all my food.
So
and
cool.
Yeah, but you know, after she passed away, I became deathly afraid of death, actually. Yeah. I never thought about it before. I had this very, you know, cavalier thought about it. Like, well, you know, we all die sometimes.
Yeah.
Big deal.
Sure.
You know?
No big deal.
And
then
somebody actually close to you dies and you all of a sudden just come into focus with this idea of our life is mortal.
Yeah.
And I have had some sports injuries throughout the last few years. And again, after every sports injury, each recovery period is longer.
Yeah.
I have to be so much kinder to my body. Mm. I can't eat the way that I used to and look the same. So it's like my runs get longer and longer so that I can still eat because I'm a foodie. Mm. So I think like all of us struggle with it to some degree. You have to make those changes and having a well life is hard. And when you have a tough day, sometimes you just think, I'm not going to exercise today. Yeah. And then one day turns into 10, right? So yeah, it's very exactly. easy yeah. for that to happen.
And to slip into that cycle.
Yeah, yeah. But there is so much positivity that you still espouse all the time. And like you said, you wrote this book and despite the haters, it's still a good book with great tips because you've lived that life too.
Yes.
You've done that and it's worked.
Very solid science. And
yeah.
You know, it's nice because every time I write a cookbook, I'm trying to push forward a little bit. So when I write these books, and I come on the doctors and I I'm explaining to them my theories and trying to get them to eat black bean brownies and met with some resistance, it's a struggle. So I'm basically trying to pitch this new idea in weight loss, like my pound a day diet book, which is essentially a book on keto, right? It was a keto book. It was a low carb book. And, it happened to have, black bean brownies in it, and Dr. Stork didn't like them. So, but with the keto book, it seems like it's the right idea at the right time. Everybody seems to know what keto is. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows it's a low carb, high fat, diet. And half the people I talk to are on it and getting success, and achieving success with it. So it's nice to have that finally. And it's funny because 3 years ago when we first conceived of this book, the Comfort Food Keto Book, we weren't sure if we should use the term keto because even 3 years ago, mm-hmm. we felt like it was a little bit experimental and might be scary.
Yes.
But it turns out 3 years later, it's really just the perfect timing for it. And the people who are doing keto, and there's a lot of them, are bored of the recipes because most keto recipes are very basic, right? It's just like eat a steak, put some cheese on it.
Yeah, it sounds great for a while.
Bacon,
but after eating bacon straight for 3 weeks, you might want something else.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I took the dishes that did well in my previous books and mm-hmm. ones that got great reactions to, including the meatballs, of course, and mm-hmm. just turned them into keto recipes.
Mac and cheese.
Mac and cheese.
Great.
There's no mac in the mac and cheese, but it's still delicious.
It tastes like mac and cheese. That's all I care about.
Exactly.
And congratulations because your book is number one today, which is so amazing.
I really can't believe it.
Yeah. Well, it shows that your hard work pays off and people just love your ideas. And again, just being creative and really using it as a way, not only a path and lifestyle towards wellness, but it's so filled with love and it's filled with passion. And I think that's why you appeal to so many people, because people look at you and they think this guy loves what he does, right? He loves what he does. He's found his passion. And not everybody can do that in their lifetime. And I think in our parents' generation, it wasn't even really about that.
No.
They come home, they put food on the table. It's great. It's a great life.
They inherited their careers usually, right? My dad was a cabinet maker because his dad was.
Right.
My mom's a seamstress because her mom was.
Right. So to really break the mold and to do your own thing is so amazing. And my podcast is all about teaching people to supercharge their life. And I think you really embody that because you have supercharged all of these aspects of your life. But also the self-care went to the bottom of things for a bit. Mm-hmm. So I think we should talk about that. Mm-hmm. I really like to give my listeners a practical tip that they can take and really improve their life that day. And I think so many people who are listening, they get it. They're like, wow, self-care after loss, any kind of loss, whether it's your physical mobility, your parents, what you thought your career looked like in one aspect, the restaurant aspect, and then doing something else, kind of reinventing your career. But all of those things are losses. And it's so hard to care for yourself after each of those losses. And you had so many at one time. So what are some tips that you can give my listeners who struggle with that? And again, still think self-care is selfish and all of those different
ideas.
One thing
keeps coming to mind because I'm speaking to you, a person who's a neuropsychiatrist, is that you should work with a therapist at any age, at any point in your life. If you can find a kind therapist who can give you direction generously and not just sit there and listen, it's going to be a game changer. It was a game changer for me. I believe that if I did not, if I wasn't the kid that got taken out of class since second grade, and I didn't find the wonderful therapist I've worked with my whole life, I don't think I'd be here talking to you. I think I might have ended up like a lot of the kids in my neighborhood, which include death from overdose, death by police, death in other forms, jail. I mean, I grew up in a really rough part of Queens, and those kids didn't have a lot to look forward to. And a lot of my really good friends ended up in very bad places. I'm not sure that wouldn't have happened to me if I didn't have the help. for some reason, people wanted to take me out of class and help me. Yeah. If you are a person who is struggling and there's someone who wants to talk to you, or if there's someone in your church or even a professional therapist that you happen to know, or if you don't mm-hmm. know, look up your in your book of insurance. There's probably someone you can go to.
Yeah.
And they are game changers. These are professionals with no agenda who mm-hmm. will listen to you talk about things that no one else will listen to.
Mm-hmm.
And I know there's a lot of people out there who say, like to say, I don't need, I'm
yes.
not crazy.
Yes.
I don't need therapy.
Yes.
I'm not a crazy person. It's so not about that. And
right.
it's come a long way too, even in my lifetime.
Yes.
From sort of like classic analysis, Freudian analysis,
that's
where
right.
you just sat and talked all the time and no one ever said, you know, you're on the right track or you're not.
No, they just lay there.
It's very different now. So that's one massive tip that I'd like to share that has been a game changer for me. Another thing is the sweet art of self-discipline, right? So
yeah.
there are times where you just have to crank that up. And
yeah.
and understand if you're depriving yourself of something that gives you pleasure, but doesn't give you health, doesn't give you peace,
mm-hmm.
you have to do the math on those decisions and decide which is more important. And for
yeah.
me right now, it's very clear I need to make choices that give me health and peace and not just pleasure.
Yes. Yes.
And that's just, it's a discipline, right? It's something you have
yeah.
to practice at.
I love both of those tips because, again, values-based decision-making, your second tip, is so important. Really having a compass so that your decisions don't just come from, like you said, that hedonic
impulse,
happiness,
yeah, yeah.
that impulse. Well, this is going to feel really good in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
It's more what's going to bring me that inner
mm-hmm.
peace
mm-hmm.
and how will I wake up tomorrow morning mm-hmm. and just feel really good about the decision that
yeah.
I made, right? And
yeah.
it's really about what you want in your soul. But I love your first tip too. And, you know, for the record, I would be honored to be called a therapist. I think therapists of all different types of training can all be really wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
My therapist that I had for a couple of years after my grandmother passed away, that was when I really felt like I need to go to therapy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm dealing with this grief and it's mm-hmm. really hard. She was an MFT and
mm-hmm.
she was one of the most brilliant therapists
mm-hmm.
that I had. And she had such a way about her that was so kind and
mm-hmm.
and so non-judgmental
mm-hmm.
because I had all of these judgments in my head, all
sure.
the shame and guilt about why I was feeling this
sure.
way, like I didn't appreciate my life, but I just had a hard time after my grandmother passed away. And it was hard for me. And she never judged me for some of the meanest thoughts that I said to myself in my head, you know, criticizing myself
right.
for still struggling
right.
with it a few months later.
Right. That's because yeah. they're professionals, right?
Yeah.
A lot of people say, well, I have my mom, I have my brother, I have my husband, I have my best friend, but it's going to be impossible for those people to be absolutely objective. They have an agenda.
Yeah.
And they may not even recognize what their agenda is while they're giving you advice. So you need someone who's agenda-free, who's objective and professionally trained.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes people shy away from it, as you just mentioned.
Yeah.
All the stigma. I came from Taiwan. I mean, psychologists weren't really a big thing there.
Yeah, I'm sure.
You know,
yeah.
if I stayed there,
yeah.
I probably wouldn't be a psychologist because
yeah.
it's not really all that accepted
yeah.
even today, even though they've made a ton of progress as well. And
yeah.
so I even had self-stigma when I was
right,
signing up
right.
for therapy, but I was
yeah.
just thinking, you know, you can't be sitting on the other side and treating patients when you've never ever been on the side of being a patient yourself and sitting in that chair.
Mm-hmm.
So that was what got me through the door. But I think what got me to stay is, like you said, really making sense of the fact that you don't have to be quote unquote crazy or suffering from
mm-hmm.
a severe mental illness
right.
to go to therapy.
Right.
Professionals can help you through difficult
right.
times in your life
mm-hmm.
and teach you coping strategies. And I'm very thankful for my experiences
mm-hmm.
in therapy.
If you need to see a psychiatrist
mm-hmm.
and you do need medicine, don't be upset with yourself.
That's okay
because
too.
It's okay. And it may help in the short term and the long term forever.
Yes.
It,
yes.
There are, you know, a number of ways to treat yourself when you're facing these obstacles. And I feel like some of the more valuable ones, like the ones we're talking about, are the ones people are most afraid of.
Right.
And then one other thing that
yeah.
I think has helped me, even though it's led to some criticism of my choices, is not being afraid to pick, to pursue things that are naturally your passion. So when I stopped cooking at a 3-star New York City restaurant and started cooking healthy food and doing triathlons, my chef friends thought I lost my mind. They thought I'm now going to be a hospital chef and cooking
oh
healthy food
gosh.
Was for hospitals and not for real chefs. And
wow, the judgment of
yeah.
Industry.
So sometimes you just have to say, but yeah, but that's what's making me feel really good. And if you're lucky enough, you can figure out a way to incorporate it into your how you earn a living.
Yeah.
And if you can do that, that's ultimately the best, right, of all things. So don't be afraid of the judgment that, which I don't think exists too much. Mm-hmm. Now everyone has three gigs and a side gig. Mm-hmm. So people are doing that much more now. So, but in the 90s, when I left a three-star restaurant to pursue whatever it was I was pursuing, yeah. people were very confused. And if you're worried about, you know, outside reaction, that's always going to be a major roadblock. So you yeah. have to just not care about that.
Right. At some point, you have to sort of block that out and do what makes sense to you and what feels good to you. Because I've always had a hobby of the performing arts. And actually, what you said really spoke to me, because I was very heavily judged when I was in my doctoral program. And people thought, oh, but you're doing musicals on the side? Are you serious about your career in psychology?
Right.
And I feel like it's okay to have both. It's okay that I like to sing and I like to dance.
It's awesome.
And it's fun. I'm still very serious about my psychology career. And in fact, it was that side hobby that really brought everything together for me. And that's why I've been so blessed and fortunate to have a career as a psychologist in the media, because that's really where those two things came together for me. So I think it's a great message for people. And I think for people who don't know where to start with their self-care, I think of self-care as having five major elements. There's the social piece, the emotional, the cognitive, where you challenge your brain, the spiritual, and the physical. And if you don't know where to start, just think of one activity to do each day that nurtures one of those areas. So, you know, take care of your body, take care of your mind. And pretty soon you start to get into a routine with it. I think it just becomes a way of life, as opposed to, oh, I'm doing self-care now. Here's the 30 minutes where I do self-care. And it doesn't have to be so robotic. It can be really free. It can be really all about your passion and maybe a way for you to find a new hobby too.
Sure.
Yeah.
Do you find that having a friend who's also, who has similar interests that, that can share your, you know, the hobbies or whatever it is that you choose to enhance your self-care are important? Like I have a friend who's really into tea.
Oh,
and so when I have tea with him, it's absolutely self-care, and it's sometimes it feels self-indulgent, but it's definitely a great moment for my, you know, inner outer health. And without him, I wouldn't have those experiences. And I know that when I was training for triathlons, my triathlon buddies really made it very easy for me to, so I think seeking out people who have similar interests and take care of themselves really well, either in any one of the ways that you describe, is helpful.
I love that
idea. Doing it on your own is challenging.
And then you kind of have to go into it yourself. So if you have somebody to do it with, then that's also great, because you get connectivity. You get that social time with the person you care about. Plus you get exposed to a new whole arena of things. And
and it's so easy to find those people now.
Yeah.
Social media, everyone has, you know, their interests on display on social media. So
exactly. And don't be afraid of trying something new. So one thing that I really got into last year was horseback riding.
Oh, and if it wasn't, fun.
Right.
How great.
And my best friend, my best girlfriend, rides horses now semi-professionally for fun, like as her hobby, but she trains and she's going to be in a show in a couple months. So if it wasn't for her, I don't think I would have gotten exposed to that.
Probably,
so I think that's a wonderful tip. Well, Chef Rocco, it's
been
an honor and a pleasure to have
it's
you.
It's been my honor. Thank
and
you.
Your book, Rocco's Keto Comfort Food Diet, is available wherever books are sold.
That's
but where else can people find you? How can people follow you?
You know, on Instagram, on all the typical social media stops. Just at my name, and I do lots of appearances in New York. So if you're ever in New York, check my social media. There might be a book signing or a dinner or something.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. And I need to see that picture of that sea urchin signature dish we're done with this. I need to take a look at that. And thank you all for joining and listening to this episode of Supercharged Life. You can follow me at Dr. Judy Ho on social media. Be sure to subscribe, download, listen, and tell your friends about this podcast. I'm Dr. Judy. Now go supercharge your life.